Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. With us this week, Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's also a member of the Board of Trustees here at WAMC and a commentator. Blair, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you. You know, and there's a reason to have you. Always, of course, but specifically Sunshine Week, which has started. This is all about transparency. Now, you've talked about this with me almost every single time we get together, the need for more transparency in government. You have a lot to say about this.
Hopefully in a transparent manner. So Sunshine Week, for everybody who's listening, is an annual event started about 20 years ago by a group of media outlets, really led by what was then called Gannett News, now known as USA Today Network. And the idea was to focus on openness in government and transparency in government, and to keep, you know, sort of pushing the envelope to make American democracy more open. So fast forward 20 years later, we've been celebrating it, trying to celebrate it in New York every year and draw attention to the issue so that lawmakers will feel some pressure to do something about opening up the government. I mean, New York is notoriously closed. We're sitting here talking today. Budget negotiations are occurring in secret. We have no idea. We'll only know in the when the negotiations are done. And, you know, whose money is it anyway? There are other states that have better laws. And so, the advocates in New York, my NYPIRG, for example, my organization and others, Common Cause, League of Women Voters, we push for additional measures every year to keep chipping away at the secrecy in government as best we can.
Give us an example. What other state is better than New York on this issue, Blair?
Well, there are states that have in their constitutions a right to open government. I'll give you an example. California, Florida, Louisiana, and Montana all have guaranteed openness in government in their constitutions, which gives the public there a greater leg up on trying to find out what's going on, because it's not like there's some law that is being ignored. There's a constitutional protection. Florida does a pretty good job, actually, the Sunshine State, in being a sunshine state when it comes to government openness as well. So those are four where it's embedded in the state constitution, and advancing a constitutional amendment is one of the things that we're trying to do here in New York as well.
And what are the chances that would pass?
Well, that one's in the long-term strategy approach. How does that sound?
That sounds like you're almost not giving up.
That's right. That's right. Hope springs eternal category of issues. There's lots of things you can do to make the law work better. I mean, in New York, given the weakness of the law, particularly the Freedom of Information law, the weakness of the law, people who ask for information and the government doesn't want to give it up can wait for months, years to get information, because the deadlines are written in such a way that they're just riddled with loopholes. And so a lot of the measures that are being advanced in the legislature are to try to plug the loopholes up and to give real deadlines and real accountability for agencies in terms of, particularly for the Freedom of Information law, both at the state and local government level. Because, you know, after all, it's a democracy, and that hinges on the rights of citizens to give their informed consent to elected officials to make decisions on their behalf. Had even informed consent with that information.
Yeah, and that's of those that are paying attention. I think we have to recognize, Blair, and you know this, that a lot of people turn away from politics, even more in some ways today because of what's in the news, and not enough people hold their legislators in their own districts to account, and then later on are complaining about what's happening to them. So part of this is that people don't pay attention, and that gives legislators almost a free pass to continue doing what they're doing and being less transparent, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, what we're talking about today is among the wonkiest of the wonky issues known as good government initiatives. I mean, the public can get riled up if the drinking water is contaminated, or if they're choking on orange-colored air because of Canadian wildfires. People may not necessarily know what to do about it, but they're unhappy about it, whereas the government secrecy is sort of like sort of what people expect to have happen. So you have to keep banging away at it. And the advocates, really the people who use these tools the most, are the independent media, or any media for that matter, but certainly the independent media, and it's their job. That's why the freedom of the press is enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. That is, in fact, their job. Outlets, even like the one we're talking on now, is to look at what the information government produces and then let the public know. Because how does Joe Smith, somewhere in the Hudson Valley, supposed to know what's going on in state government? You don't even know what question to ask. But the local media outlet, a public radio station or a local newspaper that's looking at a particular issue, they do the work and they produce the information for the public. So it all sort of works together. And that's how people get engaged in the information, is when they see it in action in their own personal lives.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're seeing a great chill of the press, though, when you look at what's happening on the national scene, which happening at what were once journalistic institutions like the Washington Post and other moves that are being made to settle lawsuits in the press. At one point, this would never happen. The press would say, take me to court every single time. I've got the truth on my side. And there's the real final nail in the coffin is disinformation, social media, and the fact that many have demonized the press, calling them fake media and the enemy of the people, that you have a wide swath of this country that doesn't trust media as it once did.
Well, that's true. The nonstop attacks on the media as being biased have had an impact. And it's basically a well-funded national, not even just national, international propaganda campaign designed to undermine the constitutional protection of the freedom of the press. So one of the ways you weaponize it is by tying institutions up in lawsuits. And while the New York Times or the Washington Post may have the resources to deal with that, little local newspapers don't. And court is expensive, particularly if it's somebody's coming after you that's a well-funded financial institution of some sort or corporation of some sort. So yes, it's challenging times. X has decided, formerly known as Twitter, not to fact check. Meta, the parent of Facebook, has decided not to fact check. And so we are increasingly awash in information, much of which is pure propaganda, lies, gaslighting, and deceit. And so how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? That is the responsibility, really, of the media, and that's why they're in the Constitution. So that's hard. There's no doubt about it. Former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brandeis once said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And that comes back to our original conversation on the sort of the wonkier side of the whole thing, is that if you make the governmental information more readily available to the public, they will then have the information or the sources of information to draw their own conclusions and to figure out how much of what they're reading online is hype and how much of it is true.
We're speaking with Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. And you are listening to The Capital Connection. I'm David Giustina. You had Lobby Day on Pass New York Health this week on the 18th. Tell us about what this is all about and whether or not we're ever going to get it in New York.
Well, you mentioned Lobby Day. We've been involved in, three of them in the past 2 weeks. And four over the past month on higher education, healthcare, on openness in government, and on the environment. We've been busy, which is what happens during the budget process at the state capitol. So we're banging around on all that. In terms of New York Health,
yes,
that is legislation designed to ensure that everyone in New York would have access to good, high-quality health coverage. And in New York, we already have a reasonably good system, certainly compared to the country, maybe not to the rest of the world, but compared to the country, roughly 98% of New Yorkers have some form of health insurance, some good health insurance, some lousy health insurance, but they have access to health insurance. And New York Health basically says everyone gets it. And it redesigns the system in a way that effectively the government is funding the health insurance for everybody, and you wouldn't have to deal with, you know, the various health insurance companies that currently run the system. Now, the advantage, of course, to that is if you're a provider, a hospital or a doctor, there's one set of rules to deal with, so that's good. If you're a consumer, by and large, you'll have better coverage, so that's good. And but if you're a health insurance company, you hate the idea because, you know, of course, that's what you do. And people are nervous about losing their health insurance because they have whatever, you know, they feel like they have something now. And anytime you talk about taking something away from people, they get nervous about that. And that makes perfect sense, particularly in a state where it's relatively good system compared to the rest of the country. Now, all of that, of course, is a roll of the dice because the new administration and Congress have decided that one of the things they would like to do is basically eviscerate Medicaid, which is the health insurance program for lower income people by and large. And if they do that, and they seem intent to, although they sort of hedge on whether or not that's really their intent, but they have talked about in the budget resolution that passed in the House and the Senate earlier this month, they're looking for $880 billion in savings in healthcare. And if you're assuming that they're not going to touch Medicare, because that's what Trump says he doesn't want to do, where else can you get it? So whatever happens, it's going to make health access more difficult thanks to the federal government. And that's going to mean at the state level, what do you do to pick up the slack? And we think a universal system is going to ultimately be the only way a state can provide coverage to all of its citizens, residents, is by doing that kind of system. But, that's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. It's in the constitutional amendment for open government category. There may be some fuel to the particular fire because of what the president and the Congress are up to in terms of cuts to programs such as Medicaid.
Yeah, I know a few years back when Richard Godfrey, who is still in the assembly and, of course, was the head of the health committee, said, you know, we could pass universal health care in this state. At the time, they had supermajorities. They had the votes, but it never seems to get done. And, you know, it almost seems accidentally on purpose, Blair.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit different when, I mean, Richard Godfrey, who was first elected to the assembly in 1970,
yeah,
finally retired recently, although I still view him as a young guy. I mean, there are competing interests. I mean, for example, I mentioned earlier, health insurance companies, they hate the idea. And it's not like they're a bunch of slouches that you could easily roll over them. Unions negotiate through collective bargaining health coverage for their members. And they're concerned about putting those agreements at risk, right? Will it be a better system than what they have now? And so, anytime you're talking about changing something as fundamental as health insurance, everyone's concerned. The people that are least likely to be concerned are the people that don't have access now, or the least, or inadequate access, and they're not the people that are the political power players. So that's what makes it harder. Everyone understands why it makes sense. If you're 65 or older, you have this option now. Now, the feds have made it unbelievably complicated and to some extent not what it's supposed to be, but you do have it at 65 and older. Everyone has access to universal health care. And, you know, why not everyone else?
Well, that's the basic question, right? Is health care a right for everybody? I'll give you my opinion. Yes, especially if you want people to be productive in the society that they live in, not get sick a lot. Drain on the system.
Yeah, imagine if we, COVID was, what did we have to do for COVID? You had to cover everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody who goes to the emergency room, you have to cover everybody. You have to, because what are you supposed to do? Tell them, sorry, you don't have health insurance. I don't care if you have COVID. You have to sit out on the sidewalk. That's not what we're supposed to be about. And the world is a more complicated place. Mm. The costs are astronomical and will continue to go up. I mean, the insurance industry just generally is facing increasing costs all across the board. And that bleeds into premiums.
Yeah.
And so the whole system is going to become more expensive. And we might as well just tackle it and do what the rest of the wealthier nations do, which is provided through, in some form, through the government.
Yeah. And you mentioned COVID, but the doctors and scientists tell us It's not if, but when the next pandemic happens. So, you know, we see bird flu out there, measles now is spreading. You know, barring that we have a real pandemic at the moment, it could come. So it could be the impetus for New York to push further for a more universal healthcare system.
Well, I mean, you know, again, that's a rational conversation.
Oh, yeah.
You fix the roof when the sun is shining, not when the thunderbolts are coming down, right? So it would be now would be a good time to recognize the long-term effects of everything you described and what else is going on in the insurance industry and decide we're going to fix the roof now. But the roofers are not here yet.
What about the rainy day fund?
Well, I assume what you're talking about is the money that the state has squirreled away for rainy days. You know, depending how you count it, I mean, the way the governor counts, it's over $20 billion now. In various reserve accounts that the state could draw down against in the event of something catastrophic happening. And I think, you know, when people think about something catastrophic happening, they think about earthquakes or tidal waves or hurricanes or tornadoes. Unfortunately, the state may have to tap into this once the federal government gets done with whatever the heck it's going to do in terms of aid to states. The Trump administration has talked about carving out $2 trillion out of federal spending. And that's got to come from somewhere. Assuming that it's not coming out of the military, it comes out of everything else. So what impact that'll have? The president says he's not going to touch Social Security and Medicare. We'll see. Let's assume it take that at face value. There's a whole lot of things that are going to get cut that the state is going to have to try, I assume, in the state of New York, is going to try to have to fill in. We mentioned Medicaid, which is the most obvious thing that will get cut in the whatever the Congress and the administration ultimately do. Now, in New York, the New York lawmakers are supposed to come up with a budget by the end of this month. April 1st is the beginning of the new fiscal year. And so they can't possibly game out what the feds are going to do. So I assume what they're going to end up doing is passing a budget based on the best information they have now. And then they may have to draw down to deal with whatever reasonable or ridiculous approaches the Trump administration and the new Congress take toward dealing with savaging or modernizing, I guess it depends on how you view those things, programs that benefit, you know, most people.
Well, let's talk a little more about savaging and move over to the issue that I know NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group, Blair Horner, is passionate about, and that's the environment. The EPA, led by former Long Island Representative Lee Zeldin, who also ran for governor of New York, has now decided to remove the P in Environmental Protection Agency. And we've even seen lawsuits by places like Climate United against the EPA for having frozen their Inflation Reduction Act funds that were passed by Congress, that were signed by the president. They're literally going after funds that are spoken for, are contracted out. There's been judge delay on that, pause while they hear the arguments. But we're seeing what seems to be the complete, absolute dismantling of regulations to protect our environment. And you got a big rally coming up next Friday when it comes to the New York Heat Act, which has not yet passed. It's on Long Island. But everything will hinge now on the federal government. And for example, I saw bald eagles are now back in huge numbers in the Northeast, but they were almost extinct because of what happened until the 1970s.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the Trump administration is violently opposed to environmental protection. There's no other way to describe it. They are doing everything they can to dismantle the nation's approach and the world's approach to dealing with the science of climate change. And they just ignore the science or say it's not true. And, you know, science is science. I mean, it evolves. We learn more over time, of course. But the planet is heating up. The oceans are hotter. And it's just been reported that 2024 was the hottest year in human history. So, you know, you can pretend, you can lie to people about that there's no danger from climate change. You can lie to people about vaccines. But that doesn't change the underlying facts. The facts are that there are pandemics. Vaccines are helpful to deal with them, like measles. Climate change is real. Drinking water contamination is real. And so the fact that the federal government now is choosing to dismantle what, in my view, pathetically little they were doing in the first place, is going to be catastrophic for human health and the environment. And we're going to pay a very heavy price. The people of the United States are going to pay a very heavy price through, you know, worse food, lousier health care, and a more polluted environment to live in. We're going to pay a heavy price for that, and there's no getting around it.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that, you know, I don't know if this is just a symbolic move or what, but the governor coming out and saying, I charge the DEC in New York for basically protecting the environment in the absence of the EPA. I mean, we know a lot of these agencies don't have the enforcement they need, which is the number of bodies that would be on the ground, you know, looking at pollution, brownfields and other things. So, I mean, you can say all you want, but I don't see how the DEC can step in and replace that role of the EPA.
Well, I mean, you know, again, this is part of the, like, how do you game out something that's so catastrophic? And so let's assume for the moment, though, the Trump administration successfully figures out how to cut $2 trillion out of the federal government. I mean, the aspiration of the governor, Governor Hochul, to have the state, you know, plug the gap is great. But, you know, like the Dutch boy, right, there's only so many holes you can cover. And, you know, again, we don't know what's going to happen. We only know what people say they want to do. And you have to accept at face value what it is they say they want to do. And so I believe that the Trump administration is going to do everything it can to eviscerate federal agencies. And I believe that Governor Hochul will do all she can to try to offset the impacts on New Yorkers as she sees it. But we don't know. And, you know, we're in uncharted waters. And, you know, I mean, the argument being made by the president that we have to cut $2 trillion out because the nation is broke and the debt is too high. I mean, that's not an unreasonable thing to be saying, but you can't couple that with a $4.5 trillion tax cut to benefit the wealthy and say at the same time you're trying to do something about the debt, because that just makes it worse. Why shouldn't the rich have to pay the price too, like the rest of us, if they really want to reduce the cost of the federal government, reduce the debt? You can't do tax cuts. And yet they are, which makes it pretty clear that what they're really doing has nothing to do with reducing the debt and has everything to do with reducing enforcement of environmental laws, public health laws, et cetera.
Well, but what do you make of a Democrat, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, say, no, we don't want to raise taxes on New Yorkers making more than $5 million a year. They pay too much as it is in taxes. Meanwhile, of course, the Assembly, Carl Hastie had said earlier in the session, revenue raisers, which essentially means taxes. So the governor not only doesn't want to do that, but she wants to send $500 in inflation refund checks to New Yorkers.
Well, again, well, if you're thinking about a budget and you're looking at it now, I mean, the state has, you know, enormous resources. You may not be able to say the same thing once you see what happens with the federal government. I think all revenue issues will be on the table, as will be cuts to programs. I mean, we will suffer. There's no getting around it. It's not like this, as you mentioned earlier, the state government can't step into the shoes of the federal government in terms of providing services in New York. They can't. They just don't have the wherewithal to do that. They may have the aspiration to do that, but again, but we don't know, right? That's the thing, right? All we know is the noise, and we watch the power saw of, you know, Elon Musk working its way through various federal agencies, cruelly throwing people to the wolves and losing their jobs. But, you know, that's what the president wants to do. So that's what Musk is allowed to do. And so, you know, how that plays out yet, though, it's still too early to tell. The state has to put a budget to bed, supposedly by April 1st, which is what it's supposed to do. And they can't put a budget together based on the kind of colossal what ifs that exist now at the federal level. It may turn out that none of these things happen, right? That the Congress decides, because there are seven House Republicans in New York, and they need every single one of them to vote with the leadership on whatever the budget is. And they all face reelection in a year and a half. And so, you know, will they be able to cobble the votes together to do that? We don't even know, right? So part of it is you can certainly imagine the worst case scenarios, because that's what people are talking about. But they may not happen, in which case what the governor's talking about may be able to, people may be able to, the lawmakers may be able to skate by. It's hard to say right now.
Well, it's hard to say this, but we have quickly run out of time. I had, let's see, higher education, consumer protection, all sorts of things to talk to you about, Blair. It's going to have to wait for another program. He is Blair Horner, the senior policy advisor for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. You can head to NYPIRG.org to find out more. Blair Horner, always a pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate you coming on each and every time I ask, even if you don't like it.
Thank you for inviting me, David, and happy spring to all of the listeners.
Yeah, let the sun shine in.
We're going to get plenty of it starting now.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.